The following is a presentation of Game Show Newsnet and the CLW 83 Network.
Jason Block here for WLTI Live Extra and the CLW83.com network, along with GameshowNewsNet.com. And my second WLT Live Extra in a week comes to us with a friend of mine who happens to be a best-selling author. He has written three books. The most recent just came out on March 5th, which is called The International Bank of Bob, Connecting Our World One $25 Kiva Loan at a Time. The man who I'm talking about is the man on the line with me now, Mr. Bob Harris. How are you, Bob?
I'm great. How are you doing, Jason?
I'm doing great. First of all, let's talk about the book. So what's the book about?
Well, it's principally focused on a wonderful charity called Kiva.org that anybody can go and play with on the web the same way that I do. It's a way that people like you and me can invest in mom-and-pop businesses in more than 60 countries all over the world. There's maybe, you know, farmers in Kenya, bicycle delivery guy in Nicaragua, whatever. And microlending, some of the pioneers of it won the Nobel Peace Prize a few years ago. And I've spent the last few years actually out in the field traveling to see how these loans actually work. It's a long list of countries, Nepal and Peru and India and Lebanon and Rwanda and Morocco, Bosnia, and actually just visiting recipients of the loans and sitting with them and meeting their kids and talking about their businesses and their hopes and their dreams. And it's been an awesome couple of years working on this, I got to tell you.
So how did you come up with the concept of the book?
Well, once I'd gotten interested in the charity, and I'd used the website a number of times, you go to Kiva, you see all these stories of people who are, you know, often in really difficult situations. You know, people in former war zones, like in Bosnia or in Iraq or, you know, really difficult places, and they're still putting their lives together. They're still going forward. And it's actually kind of inspirational. It's remarkable people, the resilience that people have. I found myself saying over and over again, in fact, you know, riding in a guy's car in Beirut or, you know, talking with people who, Peru, where hyperinflation completely destroyed the currency. And I would sit there and asking people, how are you not insane? I mean,
yes.
Seriously, like, how did you do this? I met some guys in Bosnia, really nice guys in their 20s, whose, you know, youth, their childhoods had been spent being shelled. And like, how are you, like, nice, regular guys sitting having a beer with me? How is this possible? What do you have? Where is the strength coming from? And what was really fascinating was that I got the same answers absolutely everywhere all over the world, you know, from Hindus and Muslims and Christians and atheists and everybody. And it all came down to, you know, mutual support, family. We all went through it together. It was exactly the same sort of coping mechanisms and strength reservoirs that you'd think and hope we might all have. And it was a fantastic experience. I mean, the book's about microlending. It's about how we can invest in other people all over the world. But in a much larger sense, what it ultimately just wound up being about, I think we all hope that deep down that we're all the same all over the world. I never have to wonder about that anymore. I went out and saw it. I met people in places that are supposed to be so different from here, and just kept meeting people just like my mom and dad every single place I went.
Now, which is also kind of an antithesis of your second book, which was called Who Hates Whom.
Who Hates Whom, that's about wars all over the world. You know, it's still arguing that we're all one. It's just saying, yeah, that one can be one heck of a jerk. That book actually says very much the same thing and comes to much the same conclusion, because so many of the wars start for very, very similar reasons. That's a very funny point. Nobody's ever put it that way before. That's hysterical.
Yeah. Now, when you hear the term follow the money, you know, most people think of that in a negative light. You know, for political scandal and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And you took that term and you actually met the people who you loan the money to.
That is literally what I did. I followed the money. That's exactly right. I went from, you know, my own wallet through Kiva.org. I met those people. I met people who support Kiva. I met the small banks in the field, the microfinance institutions that actually administer the loans. I met the loan officers. And then I met the actual clients, the entire chain, all of the money.
And what was, again, you may have touched on it earlier, but what was the biggest lesson you took from meeting the people you lent the money to?
Well, yeah, as I said, it was the, the way that just the remarkable similarity I kept coming across. You know, everybody's just trying to put food on the table. Everybody, everywhere I went. I mean, Cambodia, I'm walking around and you know, meeting people who, you know, survivors of the killing fields, for crying out loud. I met this one lady who now sits and she grows morning glories. I had no idea that morning glories grow so fast that they're really quite popular, profitable. It's a great business. And she's buying land and she's helping her son open a motorcycle shop. And like, she's been through hell and she can still move forward. And, you know, we all go through hard times. I think people can pick up this book and feel, you know, really connected to the world and go on some adventures to places they may not, you know, get to visit, you know, Nepal and Peru, or there's a lot of places here where people really want to go. But more than anything, there's also this sense of, well, geez, my problem, you know what, I can overcome my problems. If this woman works 19 hours a day in the Philippines to support her kid, and that's a real story, every day, yeah, you know what? I can probably push through this extra hour at the gym, you know?
Yeah. Now, how much has your Kiva.org team loaned out over the years?
There's a team. There's a team called Friends of Bob Harris at Kiva. It's actually not my team. It was founded by a guy I'd never met, who had read, I think, Prisoner Trebekistan, my book about Jeopardy. And he basically informed me that there was going to be a team called Friends of Bob Harris. You have friends. Hold still. And I sort of, okay, I guess. And then it kind of gathered momentum in ways that I'm still trying to figure out how it happened. And the simple answer to your question is it's now about $3.1 million.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, in these little $25 loans. The team's made over 100,000 of them. And there's more than 1,000 people from, I think it's like 30 or 40 countries, of whom maybe I've personally met 40 or 50. Some of them are really my actual real friends have joined. But everybody else here, I mean, these sweet people who I may never meet in person, but I see all the time on the team at Kiva.org. There's a woman named Birgit in Austria, and the woman in Australia, and these wonderful people that you kind of build a community with.
And how much have they gotten back of that money?
Oh, the repayment rate's something like 99%. I mean, it's just about precisely 99%. My own repayment rate, for some reason, I don't know why, has actually been a little higher. It's about 99.4%. So,
So, in other words, there's been a default rate of less than a half a percent.
Yeah, something in the ballpark of a half a percent on my loans, And I've done like 53 or 5,400 of them. I don't know exactly how many. And the Kiva wide in its history is like 99%. The thing is, I mean, it's charity you can sort of use over and over again. You know, if you you can put the money in, you're helping somebody's business, and you know they repay it, and you can put the money back in again, and that's kind of fun. You feel like your own foundation. You know, when the bicycle mechanic in the Philippines repays you, and there's the cab driver in Mongolia, I think I'll help that guy, and then you can just move the money over there. And if you compare it to what would you get in a checking account right now, keeping the money there?
Less than one. What is it, about 1% now these days?
Yeah, you get maybe okay. So the cost to you is let's see, instead of getting 1% in your savings account, and like savings accounts are paying almost nothing right now. You know, savings account, a CD, whatever, percent to whatever. So if you're willing to give up just a couple of percent, your money can be spending all of its time actually helping people, and then still come back to you at the end. And for me, that's like a total no-brainer. I mean, it's charity that I have put tens of thousands of dollars into this, and I still have my tens of thousands of dollars, but I also got to help 5,000 businesses all over the world. How do you not do this? I don't understand.
Well, I mean, because this leads me to my next question. Do you believe that Kiva and other funding places like Kickstarter and others are a trend to return financial transactions to the level of people to people and away from the bigger banks to people?
Well, yeah, I think it's a trend that nobody really knows how it plays out or what it looks like. You know, it would have been possible, I think, you know, 15... It's one of the things I write about in the book is the technological change is happening so fast that, I mean, we can barely imagine next week, much less what things are going to look like in 20 years. But I it's clearly part of a trend. I would actually frame it more in terms of social enterprises, the things that people use for, you know, when people are building businesses whose goal is to, you know, make profit, but also be doing good while you're at it and you know, returning profit and kind of creating general wealth as opposed to just, you know, individual profit. And social enterprise, I mean, you never even heard that word 10 years ago. And now it's like, you know, this very, very common term in an ever-increasing segment of society and the business community. It's just an exploding field. Business schools are teaching it and you know, there are clubs sprouting up in high schools. I think that's a direct extension of the way communications have exploded. You know, now, I mean, geez, you know, you can go to the most remote place in Kenya and you can get a cell phone signal practically. You can, like, anywhere in the world, there's, you know, remarkable communications. And so inevitably, we're all going to start seeing each other more clearly. And that has revolutionary, I mean, fundamental possibility. I mean, it's huge hope here. There's a whole generation of humanity growing up right now. I don't think people talk about this enough. If kids who are 10 years old right now, all over the world, all at once, are growing up unable to imagine a world in which people live, you know, completely separate, distinct, you know, like there's like a world without instant communication with almost anywhere on the planet. Even people growing up on the wrong side of the global divide can still the digital divide, is going to look across the fence and see this connecting world. And in 30 years, kids who can't imagine a non-connected world all take political power, and they're going to be running corporations, and they're going to be making the big decisions. The world is going to be fundamentally different. It just is. There's going to be people with a completely different set of presumptions running the place. And I find that unbelievably hopeful.
Well,
I hope I live long enough to see it.
Well, I hope so too. It sort of reminds me, sort of, I think I'm old enough. I just turned 45. That I remember days when you used to, the days of what we called pen pals, where you used to write where you used to write letters and wait 2 to 3 weeks to get something back. And now and now you can instantly Skype classrooms all over the world. And that's bringing the world so much closer to you.
Yeah.
And I believe this whole advances of online technology have affected the business of microtransactions in such a way that we don't – that you just stated that we don't even know the possibilities yet of this.
Yeah. Oh, there are potentials now in terms of banking where things can be done anywhere a cell phone signal can reach. People are developing right now text-based, just SMS-based methods of actually bringing financial tools to people who have been just in the past completely unreachable. The abilities, it's really almost like anything we can imagine somebody's working on right now. And it's just breathtaking. I sit and talk with people, and some of the stuff I've seen. In Kenya, they have a banking system there that in some ways is so much more advanced than ours. They have a mobile banking system called M-Pesa, where it's rigged into people's cell phones. And if I'm going to buy something from you, I can just whip up my phone and key in a code, and you key in some codes in your phone, and the transaction's done. Securely, portably, I don't have to carry money. It's highly secure. And this is just a revolution because countries that are struggling a little bit where people have to maybe, go to the city to make money and try to send money home to their family in the village. Now the money can be transferred instantly and really securely. People's lives, immediately improve with the speed of text messaging. And the whole banking system is being transformed this way. It's something like 40% of everybody in the country now is using this system. And so that means that, people who previously couldn't even be reached with, a bank branch in their small village or something like that. Now they can create savings. They can even, get insure things. And there's just a remarkable things people are imagining. And that's the sort of thing that's going to start spreading to country after country. And literally, you can go right now. There's a Kiva Zip is a program where on the Kiva website, individuals like you and me, I can just, without even a lender in between, I can directly lend to a guy in East Bungoma, Kenya. That's actually a real town. And send $50, here's $65, and the guy's got a delivery business, maybe it's a woman with a cooking business or whatever. They make the bakery, and they sell their cakes, they make their profit, and they just pay me directly back. It's just literally me lending to a guy in Kenya right through the internet. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Now, to those people who, for our listeners who have wondered what you've done since Jeopardy,
uh-huh.
I'm switching it up a little bit here. You've been doing some TV writing on shows that included CSI and Bones. Could you tell us a little about that?
Oh, sure. I'm not a big TV writer. It comes up now and again. I worked for CSI in its third season. It's been about 10 years now. When CSI was first blooming, it was the year that it sprouted CSI Miami and became the world's biggest TV show. I had the luckiest career ever. I just had decided I wanted to get involved in TV writing and handed a spec script to a buddy of mine who knew a guy at CSI, and they read it, and they said, yeah, let's hire this guy. And boom, I'm on the number one show in the world. And the pressure was staggering. And so I did that for a while, and I wrote one episode of Bones a few years ago that was really fun. But my favorite TV gig ever, truthfully, was when in 2007 I was invited to go down to Mexico and run the writer's room on a primetime action novella down there, which was just a trip. I didn't speak any Spanish at the time, but I was like, okay. And I got on the plane. Next thing you know, I'm in Mexico City, and I'm in this writer's room. And, tight clothing is worn, and action is had, fists are thrown. It was Mexican television. It was fantastic. It was so much fun to work on.
That was La Pantera, right?
El Pantera, yeah. It was fantastic. It was this brooding guy with a dark complexion and a tight black T-shirt and well muscled, and the girls could go and he had no superpowers whatsoever, but he would just kind of hang out in this one neighborhood and kick some butt when butt needed to be kicked. It was wonderful. It was so cheesy. I felt like Roger Corman or something. It was. I would stand in that room and we'd come up with these stories, and I had to learn. There are actually fundamental differences in storytelling structures between some of the ways that, are derived kind of from the British novelistic three-act sort of tradition and the traditions they have in Mexico. And so we sort of had to negotiate even storytelling structures It was every day. Everyone should run a telenovela once in their lives.
Now, are you still involved in sort of the trivia circuit at all?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You know, there's certainly the cutthroat, you know, arm to the teeth back alley Jeopardy games that are played for blood.
I've been to those. It involves alcohol.
Yeah.
I've been involved with lots of alcohol and copious fried food.
Sure. Yeah, there's the trivia championships in North America in August every year. I'm not one of the organizers, but I'm part of it. I'm there. I organize some of the events. There was a game we played last year that I and Paul Daly, the head organizer of the trivia championships, and a fellow named Jason Perlman put together called Nodgeball, which is speed trivia done while playing two-on-two dodgeball.
Wow.
And it is so much fun because you're playing dodgeball and your brain just is, you're trying to do two completely different things. You know, who was Abraham Lincoln's second vice president? Well, the ball is coming right at your head is a very different question than, you know, when you're standing with a buzzer in your hand. And we had a wonderful tournament and nobody got hurt, zero body count. And it should be, we're going to do an even bigger event this year. That should be really fun.
Now I want to end this with, I think, the most important question I'm going to ask you this entire interview. How are the Indians going to do this year?
How are the Indians going to, oh my God, they're dude, you know my heart. The Indians are going to suck in a kind of historic fashion. I think, honestly, they are going to suck in a way that may cause, that news may bring on the Mayan apocalypse that we didn't get. Their staff ERA for their starters last year was about 5. If you look at it, and that's they went out and they paid millions of dollars to get Mark Reynolds, who's like a career 220 hitter, and Nick Swisher, who like hit 237 when he wasn't playing for the Yankees loaded lineup when he played for the White Sox, and Drew Stubbs, who's like a 210 hitter, and they like paying these guys. I mean, look, it would make sense. I could get it if these guys were like drinking in an alley and the Indians found them and they said, hey, we'll clean you up, man. You know, and they brought them in and they let them play for free. Okay, that's a humanitarian thing. Maybe the Indians could even give them Kiva loans and help, you know, loan them and help them start their baseball businesses. But they actually intentionally went out and got three guys who hit like 220, and because they're going to make the team better. So imagine you're another team walking into play against the Indians. They're going to give you 5 runs, and they've got 3 guys in their lineup who hit 220. You've already won the game. I mean, I don't even know why they're bothering to play this year. I really don't.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you and Drew Carey can kind of commiserate over a beer or two because it's long.
Yeah.
It's long suffering. Bob, it's been an absolute pleasure. If you want to just promote sort of like any Facebook or Twitter and all your books, so go for it.
Yeah. Well, the main thing, the main plugage, is I'd recommend people to go to bank-of-bob.com, just Bank of Bob with hyphens, and that's the sort of like the website for the book. That's got reviews and synopsis and blurbs and, you know, all that kind of stuff and buying information, or just, you know, check it out on Amazon. The book's called The International Bank of Bob, and it's doing really well. I think the nice thing about it, I'm going to finish the plug by saying this, if the book sells, you know, I'm going to get a little bit of money. I've already put a big chunk of what I've got from the book back into the loan, so it's not for my own benefit. The book, if it brings new lenders in, and I did the math on this already, just in the book's first week of release, and I can work the math out for you. I won't waste your time. But long term, the number of new Kiva lenders and loan volume that might be brought in, the book itself may have already gotten long-term more than 500 businesses financed, which, that's an amazing feeling. That's so cool. So, you know, go to Kiva.org, make some loans, read the book, I don't know, and don't watch the Indians.
and of course, I think you're at Bob Harris for your Twitter.
Yeah, my Twitter is bobharris.com, spelled out BOTCOM. And the website is bobharris.com. Facebook, the handle is Bob Harris, spelled out Bob Harris, B-O-T-C, and bobharris.com. I think that's pretty much, that's my entire earthly existence shared with everyone on the internet in perpetuity.
Well, yes, and also just a couple, and of course, do not forget the other two books, which are Prisoner of Trebekistan, A Decade in Jeopardy, and Who Hates Whom, which, by the way, are both fantastic books. The Prisoner of Trebekistan, by the way, for those who really want to get into sort of not just sort of a it's a combination personal memoir and sort of Jeopardy primer. The one thing that I just want to just comment on this before we end this. The one thing that I always got about when you wrote about Jeopardy, the three words, reading the clue. When you kept, you know, when I said those words and I watch Jeopardy every night, I'm like, wow, that makes Jeopardy like 10 times easier. And we've both been on the show, and it's, it's just like reading the clue. Wow, who knew?
Yeah,
but
actually paying attention. Yeah, I know. The thing about Jeopardy is it's not a test of knowledge; it's a test of self-knowledge. It's a test of your ability to not buzz in if you're not sure. The game does not ask you 61 questions. The game gives you 61 opportunities of self-knowledge. Of, do I know this? Do I really know this? I don't really know this. And I have modesty. And you put the buzzer down, and you walk away. You let somebody else take the points. And then this one, oh, I do know this one. That's actually how you win the game.
Yeah, and one of the most amazing things, and then I'll finally end, is you got to officiate a wedding on stage. Of Jeopardy.
That was awesome.
Yeah, I looked at that, and I just think the fact. By the way, did you write the questions or did the staff write them?
the wedding was planned by the celebrants, Dan Melia, who kicked my butt in the 1998 Tournament of Champions, and his lovely bride Dara. When they decided to get married, they asked me to. We'd stayed, close friends, Dan, despite kicking the hell out of me. He's actually a very nice guy. And when they said, we're going to get married, and they said, Bob, why don't you do the wedding? And then it was 5 seconds later, they said, we should do it at Jeopardy. And I kind of rolled my eyes. I was like, hey, come on, it's not going to happen. But the producers are really cool, and they've got a wonderful sense of humor, and they're just neat. So after this one day of taping a few years ago, I think it was 2006, I think it was, end of the day of taping, the contestants are hustled off, and King's World brings out, they decorate the set with flowers, the game board, the categories were love, marriage, potent potables, I can't remember what the rest of them were. I mean, they played the Think music during the vows, so, do you take this woman? And then they actually played the Think music, and the...
How many times when you get married do people, do the guys or women go, that's going through my head right now, the Think music?
probably. Yeah, the vows were actually done in the form of a question. Honest to God, they got married saying, what is I do, Bob?
Yeah, that's fantastic.
It was a beautiful, beautiful thing. And it's on YouTube. You can find it on YouTube. Just Google Jeopardy Wedding. You'll see it.
Yeah, well, again, Bob, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule for this. The International Bank of Bob, connecting our world, $125 Kiva loan at a time. This is Jason Block for CLW83.com and WLTI Live. Bob, thanks again.
Hey, thank you, Jason. Thanks so much.
All right.
If you have any questions or comments about WLTI Live, please submit it to clw3network@gmail.com. This has been a presentation of both Game Show NewsNet and the CLW 83 Network. Tune in.